grizzly bears eat the nuts in the pine cones. Many other species eat those nuts too because they're rich in fats and proteins and they're valuable to them. What we see, though, is that grizzly bears do not eat them every year because the trees under natural conditions don't produce nuts every year. Some years they produced a lot of cones, some years they don't produce any cones. So under normal conditions, bears eat them when they're available, and in some years they don't have any cones and they eat other things. So they're used to switching back and forth between other foods. What we've seen with the double whammy of the blister rust and the mountain pine beetle is a decline in white bark production in the Yellowstone ecosystem, and therefore less and less white bark available for the bears to eat.
Cutthroat trout as well.
Cutthroat trout as well, right.
Speaking of double whammy, that's a double whammy.
It is, but cutthroats are a species that are available during a very small time period, about 2 weeks, where they enter the spawning streams around Yellowstone Lake, and they're available to the bears. The rest of the time, they're in the lake, and the bears can't get to them at all. What we've seen is a decline in the cutthroat trout because somebody introduced lake trout into Yellowstone Lake. In the big picture of things, cutthroats were never a major food for grizzly bears in Yellowstone because they're available for a very small time period, and perhaps 5 to 10% of the bears actually took advantage of them for that two-week period.
What else do they eat then?
Oh, they eat a wide range of foods. There are several hundred foods that bears have been known to eat in the Yellowstone ecosystem, 75 of which are eaten on a frequent basis. Insects, plant material, berries, animals, either dead animals or animals that are killed. But let's get back to the white bark issue, because the white bark is the big issue that the courts kind of held us up on when we talked about delisting the Yellowstone bears.
Correct.
We were upheld on all the issues when we proposed delisting, except the issue of declines in white bark. And the courts told us that they were not convinced that declines in white bark would not threaten the grizzly bear. And that's why the grizzly bear recovery and delisting was overturned by the federal courts. And so we went back in the spring of 2012 and evaluated what to do. Should we give up on recovery and delisting forever? Should we propose another rule with what we knew at that point? Or should we produce a very detailed food synthesis on how the changes in foods in the Yellowstone ecosystem are affecting the health and welfare of the Yellowstone grizzly population? What we chose to do was to produce that food synthesis. And it was led by USGS, which is the science arm of the Department of Interior. They took 18 months to produce this document. And they very comprehensively examined not just declines in white bark, but all other foods. And they measured various things. For example, we can measure the body fat in individual bears. Every time we catch a bear, we can measure the body fat within a couple percent. One of the hypotheses was, well, if foods are declining, particularly white bark, then the bears wouldn't be as fat over time. And particularly in poor white bark years, they would be thinner and there wouldn't be as much fat. Looking at that, there's no difference in the body condition of grizzly bears in either good or bad white bark years. And there's been no difference in the body fat of grizzly bears before white bark started to decline and now when it's been declining for some time.
Am I wrong in saying that right about when the white bark population started to decline, the grizzly population slowed a little bit?
It did. It slowed about 2000. The decline in white bark started about 2001. And so there was a break point. The population was increasing at about 7% per year, and then it started to level out into about 1% to 2% per year about the year 2000. If you'd see a slowing of population growth that way, it could be because the foods are declining and the bears aren't reproducing as much and they're not as good in body condition. Or are the bears in the Yellowstone ecosystem starting to fill all the available habitat? As the populations get denser and denser, they compete with foods with each other. They compete with space with each other, and they start to slow down in population growth. And every indicator that they measured showed that it was related to density-dependent effects and not declines in white bark. The population in Yellowstone is pretty much achieving carrying capacity. We know that it's been in carrying capacity in the Yellowstone area in the national park for some time. That population is full, quote unquote. Outside, as the bears occupy all the available space and public lands in the Yellowstone ecosystem, they're basically starting to slow down because they filled the space. Remember, when the bear was listed, they occupied about 9,200 square miles in the Yellowstone ecosystem. Today, they occupy over 19,000 square miles. Grizzly bears have occupied places in the Yellowstone ecosystem where they've been gone for more than 100 years. So we see them down in the Wind River Range and the Owl Creek Range and the Beartooth Plateau. We see more and more bears close to Red Lodge and places like that, places where they've been gone for a long time.
I'm going to go back just 1 second. The food study that you were talking about, critics say it, A, has not been peer-reviewed, and B, presented to the public.
The report that was presented to the IGBC and is out on the website went through internal USGS peer review, where two independent peer reviewers reviewed the report, made comments to the study team, and they had to incorporate all those comments into the document before it was released. So it was peer-reviewed. Secondly, each of the individual studies that are in that overall report have either already been submitted and are in publication or will soon be submitted and into peer review. So over the next 6 months, every one of those individual studies will be in peer-reviewed documents as well. So we're looking at actually a double peer review.
IGBC this week made a fairly significant recommendation, and it is not to delist. Explain what this decision is and what it means.
Okay, the ultimate authority to list or delist a species lies with the Fish and Wildlife Service. The IGBC doesn't make a recommendation to delist or not. What they did was they recommended that based on the results of this food report is that we proceed to build a new proposed rule and put that out for public comment. When we delist something, we build a proposed rule, we put it in the Federal Register for public comment, 120 days of public comment, then we evaluate those comments, and then reach a final decision. That final decision is what actually delists the species. It'll probably be sometime in 2015 that the final decision would be made if we decide to build a new rule.
How big would the recovery zone in the Yellowstone ecosystem be? About 6 million acres-ish?
You know, I can't tell you what it is in acres. It's about 9,200 square miles is the recovery zone. And by the way, most of the bears live within that 9,200 square miles. As you go further outside there, the density of bears drops off. So they do occupy up to 19,000 square miles in the system, but the majority of the bears live inside the recovery zone, or after delisting, it would be called the primary conservation area. And to give you a feel for that, Yellowstone National Park is about 3,400 square miles. So about a third of that recovery zone is Yellowstone National Park, and then the rest of it is national forest land. Now, it's important to realize that within the core area, that 9,400 square miles, there are limits on no new road development, no new livestock allotments, and no new site developments. And that is institutionalized upon delisting of the grizzly bear.
What sort of hunting opportunities would a potential delisting open up for the grizzly?
I can't say if there would be sport hunting or how much. I know that it would be very carefully regulated. It's important to realize that there are strict limits on human-caused mortality that would be in place, human-caused mortality from all sources. If hunting took place, it would have to take place within that sustainable mortality limit as well. It's very carefully managed. It would be probably a very limited number if it happened, and it would never be anything that would threaten the grizzly bear.
In this age of shrinking funding, sequestration, ceaseless budget bickering in D.C., what would this cost, and where would the money come from?
Right now, it costs us about $3 million a year to manage and monitor the Yellowstone grizzly population, and we would continue that same level of management and monitoring after delisting.
It would hold at $3 million?
You bet. The reason that it would is that we built this very gold-plated management plan, which is called the conservation strategy, which has been upheld by the court system, that would be the post-delisting management plan. And it calls for all this careful monitoring and management that would continue, whether the bears delisted or not.
If it happens, what happens after the Yellowstone ecosystem?
Well, the next one in line is the Northern Continental Divide population. Now, that population is about 1,000 grizzly bears. That's in the Glacier Bob Marshall Complex. We've already written the draft post-delisting management plan there called the conservation strategy. We're right now incorporating all the public comments into that document. When we're done with that, we'll begin to write the rule to propose to delist the NCDE population as well, because that population is very healthy and robust as well. We have grizzly bears moving all the way out toward Great Falls on the prairie, south of Ovando, way south into the Blackfoot Valley. We've got them crossing to the west, crossing Highway 93 into the Flathead River on the Indian Reservation up there and into the Salish Mountains to the north.
What do you have to say to Montanans, rural Montanans in particular, who are concerned about growing populations of these large, powerful predators in their, and I'm doing the air quote, backyards, if you will?
What we tell the public and what we commit to them is that when there are conflicts between humans and bears, that we will deal with those bears and manage those conflicts. So if somebody has a problem, we'll go in and help them out, all the way from providing electric fencing assistance, so that if they have chickens or livestock where maybe there's depredations, we'll put electric fences around them, help them providing bear-proof garbage containers, educating them about how to minimize conflicts, say don't leave dog food on the porch and then you won't have bears on the porch, all the way to the point that if there is a conflict, we'll capture and relocate those bears. And if need be, there's repeated conflicts, we'll remove them. It's also important for everybody to recognize that the majority of grizzly bears are not involved in conflicts and don't have anything to do with people. And just because grizzly bears are in an area doesn't mean you're going to have conflicts. Usually the conflicts arise because people do things to bring bears into trouble. I mean, we need to build more knowledge into the public on how they can minimize their potential for conflict with bears, not just grizzly bears, but black bears as well. And we're committed to helping the public achieve that.
Last question, Chris, and that is, you're not a wolf guy. I'm not going to drag you into the wolf issue, but I'm curious, what have you and your colleagues learned about delisting from the wolf issue that could possibly be applicable to delisting of bears?
That's a good question. fundamental to achieving recovery is to make sure that the public is supportive of recovery and the species, and the political forces are supportive of the species. The way to do that is to maintain, careful management goals, and when we achieve those goals, which are recovery goals for these species, that we delist them and transfer management carefully over to the state agencies in terms of habitat management to the Forest Service, Park Service, and BLM. If we block that process where the public feels that they've invested a lot of effort in help achieving healthy populations, and yet recovery never occurs because of blockages in the federal court system, then they tend to throw up their hands and say, we're tired of it. That's essentially what happened with wolves. We eroded public and political support for wolves by the blockage of the recovery of wolves in the federal court system. That resulted in Congress getting involved in the delisting of the wolf and congressionally delisting the wolf in Idaho and Montana. The way it should be done is under the Endangered Species Act. When we achieve our goals, that we move forward and transition into recovered status with careful management under the ESA. The future of those bears and the future of their offspring lies with the people that are out there living, working, and recreating in bear habitat. And it's critical that we maintain their support.
But don't you think that animosity towards the wolf in some sectors of Montana is every bit a cultural thing? Montanans have long memories, and there was a lot of anger about wolves and their livestock, et cetera, et cetera. Does the same apply, that cultural, if you will, aspect apply to grizzlies?
We don't see the amount of animosity toward grizzly bears that people have toward wolves. Wolves generate so much emotion. You can go into any bar and restaurant in Montana and you can hear people around you talking about wolves, no matter where you go. And most of the information is not biologically correct. We don't see that with grizzly bears. And we don't want to get to that point with grizzly bears. People like having bears around. And in many places in Montana, ranchers like having bears on their property now. Whereas if they talk about the way their grandfather thought of bears, they wanted to get rid of them. Now we have guys on the Rocky Mountain front who live with grizzly bears and see grizzly bears every day on their property, and they like that.
Why?
I don't know. It's just, grizzly bears are neat. They're really neat animals to have around. We live in a very unique place that we have grizzly bears still here. Grizzly bears used to be found throughout the western United States, and there are very few areas where they're still here. We just have to balance the needs of people with the needs of bears.
United States Fish and Wildlife Service Grizzly Bear Recovery Coordinator Chris Servine, your time is valuable. Always good talking. Thank you.
Good talking to you, Ed. Thank you.